another episode of In With The Old. We are the podcast focused on dispelling myths, building appreciation for God's word, and helping you rediscover the Old Testament for the life of faith. My name is Dr. Tim Howe, and I'm joined by Dr. Brian Koning as we continue through our series on Habakkuk. And Brian, we're going to dive into Habakkuk chapter 3. We're going to be reading through 15 verses of Habakkuk's poem as he comes to the end of this letter or this vision. But Dr. Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Tim. I've really appreciated this series. I think it's come at a very appropriate time in both your and I's lives as a reminder of God's faithfulness, right? That God is the God who is in his temple. And that gives comfort. No matter the circumstances we are through. I've been enjoying talking through the series with you. I'm really looking forward to today as well. Chapter 3, we're making kind of the turn into the back half of the book. And there's a lot of interesting, kind of maybe odd content. Listeners, if you're reading through the book, you get to chapter 3 and you go, whoa, we no longer have a dialogue between two people. Now it's a poem. It's a psalm. And a psalm with some odd imagery. But it's going to be fun to unpack it today and next week as we finish out the content of this book. So I'm ready to get to it. Let's go.
All right. Well, readers, we're going to be reading Habakkuk chapter 3. We're going to be reading there verses 1 through 15, Habakkuk's poem, Habakkuk's psalm. I'm going to be reading it from the Christian Standard Bible. So let's dive into it. Habakkuk 3, a prayer of the prophet Habakkuk according to Shigionoth. Lord, I have heard the report about you. Lord, I stand in awe of your deeds. Revive your work in these years. Make it known in these years. In your wrath, remember mercy. God comes from Timon, the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. His brilliance is like light. Rays are flashing from his hand. This is where his power is hidden. Plague goes before him, and pestilence follows in his steps. He stands and shakes the earth. He looks and startles the nations. The age-old mountains break apart. The ancient hills sink down. His pathways are ancient. I see the tents of Cushan in distress. The tent curtains of the land of Midian tremble. Are you angry at the rivers, Lord? Is your wrath against the rivers? Or is your rage against the sea when you ride on your horses, your victorious chariot? You took the sheath from your bow. The arrows are ready to be used with an oath. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains see you and shudder. A downpour of water sweeps by. The deep roars with its voice and lifts its waves high. Sun and moon stand still in their lofty residence at the flash of your flying arrows, at the brightness of your shining spear. You march across the earth with indignation. You trample down the nations in wrath. You come out to save your people, to save your anointed. You crush the leader of the house of the wicked and strip him from foot to neck. You pierce his head with his own spears. His warriors storm out to scatter us, gloating as if ready to secretly devour the weak. You tread the sea with your horses, stirring up the vast water. All right, Brian. So we have this psalm, not exactly something that might be bit bopping on the Christian top 20 billboard, but there it is.
Yeah.
As we come to the end of Habakkuk, Brian, maybe you can help us. Can you situate us here with a big idea that can kind of focus our attention as we think about this psalm? And then also, can you just walk us through some of this imagery? Walk us through what Habakkuk is doing in this. Go for it, Brian.
Yeah, so definitely these are not some of the attributes or descriptions of God we're going to hear on K-Love, are we, Tim? Right? but that's part of what I've always loved with the Old Testament, and not to denigrate how we usually worship God and those songs, right? But we often focus on a select number of attributes, descriptions, biblical ones and good ones. But the Old Testament is replete with very vivid imagery of God. And here we have a psalm really extolling some of that. So listeners, in my intro, I said, right, we've made a switch in some fashion. Chapter 2 is the conclusion of the book. It really is. 2:20, Habakkuk 2:20 is the point of the book. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. Chapter 3 is the epilogue. Right? This whole book has been a dialogue between a prophet and God, and the prophet wrestling through, how do I fit my conceptual theology with my lived experience. Well, he's now received all of his information, and this chapter is the working out of that as he applies what God has taught him. And we get to see that he's learned the lesson. This chapter is part of why I love the book, is we get to see a man come to terms. He's asked God a difficult question. He's received difficult truth. And here we see him putting it all together. So it's unlike the rest of the book. This is a psalm, which is kind of interesting. And Tim, let me answer at least for myself, but then I want to hear your answer as well. Why the switch to a psalm here in chapter 3 for the conclusion? I like to think of it in some ways that there are some theological truths that are so fundamental and so central to our being that we have no other way to express them except through poetic expressions like this. Worship, praise, music, artistry, these seem to be core to how God has created us. Mm-hmm. We see it in eternity in the new heavens and new earth that worship goes on forever. And I think at key points we see when we're trying to encapsulate this vivid and emotionally charged, and it is emotionally charged, right? Theological truth. There's no better medium than a psalm. And so I kind of like it that we switch to that. It invites us more than just a listing of facts. It invites us in to consider this truth and how it applies to us. I think at least that's how I would answer why we have a psalm here. Tim, why do you think we've switched to a psalm here in chapter 3?
Totally agree with you, Brian. And I'm reminded here of why so much of the poetic literature that we read in the Bible comes from the prophets, because by definition, they're dealing with some of the most emotionally wrought, emotionally difficult things that people go through. I go back to the Book of Lamentations. The Book of Lamentations is arguably one of the most emotive books in all of Scripture. You have Jeremiah sees the downfall of Jerusalem. He sees the destruction of really everything he knew. And so as he's trying to come to terms with this, he uses this vivid emotional energy and this vivid emotional imagery, and he writes the Book of Lamentations. But what do we know? The Book of Lamentations is also one of the most structured books in the entire Bible. It uses a multi-level acrostic in every chapter. And so as we think about that, we tend to separate our thought, our analysis from our emotions. They didn't do that. It was almost like there was this flood rushing of a river in terms of their emotions and their responses. And so in order to guide that, in order to draw out those emotions, they used poetry as a means of doing that. So I love your answer, Brian. I totally agree with you. In dealing with the most difficult things in life, prose just doesn't suffice. And we see that here at the end of the book of Habakkuk.
Yeah. Excellent points, Tim. So as we transition to the psalm, we open with a heading, right? The prayer of the prophet Habakkuk according to Shigionoth. Now, listeners, you're like, hey, we've got a Habakkuk scholar in here. He'll tell us what this word means. Are you ready for it? We have no idea. It's one of those words. It's clearly a music from context, right? It's a musical notation or an arrangement notation. We have other psalms that have other terms like this. It has to do with the presentation of this song. If you scroll down to the bottom of the chapter, you also see there's a note to the choir master there that this is meant for stringed instruments. Mm-hmm. So don't know what it means, but we know in context that's kind of what is going on. Verse 2 is the header. And the header is important because it's Habakkuk saying, I get the point. And it's a cry for mercy, right? The bold and presumptuous prophet of chapter 1 now has hat in hand, is abasing himself before God and says, in your wrath, remember mercy. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful kind of journey we get to see the prophets gone on. Mm-hmm. Starting in verse 3 and going through verse 15 that Tim read for us, this is a recapitulation of Israel's history, specifically focused on God's appearing, a theophany, right? Mm-hmm. And his power. Tim, I love how you read it because throughout this passage, there are several salahs. As any worship pastor knows, salah means guitar solo. Oh, wait, no, it doesn't mean that. It means to, right, stop, reflect on what has just been said. So I encourage you, listeners, as you read through this on your own, kind of see where those have been placed. They don't fall on the verse breaks all the time. Only one actually falls on a verse break. Remember, verses aren't inspired. They're added later. But they're placed after points of emphasis, right? Where the writer Habakkuk here is asking you to reflect on what he has just said. Visualize the scene in your head. And what we see is God is being presented as a warrior who punishes, a warrior who delivers. And it's a beautiful poem going back through and blending together key images of Israel's history. Mm-hmm. Now, I like this, Tim, and we'll get into the details here in a moment, but we're blending together elements of the exile, elements of the journey of in the wilderness, of the conquest of Canaan. We're taking elements from all these stories and blending them together. I find so powerful because Habakkuk, what he's trying to push for us listeners is to recognize that God is present in our history, because there are times in the moment, and Habakkuk is in one of those moments right now, where he's like, I can't see God in the present. But in those times, we should remember our past. God was there then. He'll be there now. God was holy and powerful then. He delivered then. He can do that again. And that's what the story is going to be drawing upon. Look, nation of Judah, right? The people, God has been with us before. Pull back the veil of nature, as I put in the notes for myself. We didn't deliver ourselves. We didn't get out of Egypt by our own power. We didn't defeat the Cushites, the Midians, the Edomites. We didn't do all these things on our own. It was our God who was with us. And as we are about to face down kind of our darkest hour, militarily speaking, remember our God is a warrior. And our God is a powerful God, right? That's kind of the theme that's going to run through this. And that's helpful. And as Tim and I both reflected, there are some really interesting descriptions we'll jump into here in a moment. Tim, before we start pulling out some of those interesting descriptions, any other kind of high-level points before we jump into the weeds a little bit?
Yeah, just one, Brian. I think it's important for us to see how Habakkuk has this sense of a corporate identity and that identity bleeding from the past into the present. And the reason I wanted to mention that is because in our culture, and I would argue this, at least in the United States currently, other cultures are a little bit different. We tend to isolate ourselves from the past as history that somehow applies or changes the present, or we just divorce ourselves from history. And for Habakkuk, that's exactly the opposite of what he did. And it's also the opposite of what we see basically everyone do in the scriptures. There is a continuity of identity so that whenever, for instance, Habakkuk looks at the Exodus as a motif, he says, God, you have done this for us in the past. Therefore, you are going to do it for us now. It wasn't a you did it for them. It's we find ourselves in continuity and in solidarity with our ancestors. And therefore, you are the same God. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is our God. The promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are our promises. And so I think in a very individualistic modern Western society, we just need to name there is a corporate solidarity here. There's a corporate identity that is so crucial to understand, because if we don't, we might say, well, he's just picking up on, you know, an image of the past. No, it's deeper than that. It's not just that he's using images of the past. He's saying, we stand in the line of our ancestors. You delivered them, you made promises to them, and we are claiming them for ourselves as a way to remind ourselves, you are the same God yesterday, today, and forevermore. So I just wanted to sharpen that just a tiny little bit for us before we look at some of these details. But Brian,
no, and that's a good reminder, Tim. Because stealing a little bit from our conclusion to this book, one of the challenges Habakkuk gives us, I think, is that sin has a collective nature, right? What drives this book forward is not the sin of Habakkuk, is not the sin of his family, it's the sin of his nation. And that's a question we have to wrestle with as Christians, right? Yeah. Not everything in the Old Testament pulls over neatly into the New Testament. But at what level do we have to wrestle with sins of our nation, sins of our communities in a collective sense? That's not a comfortable conversation, but it's one that Habakkuk really pulls forward. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off. Didn't mean to jump in there. Go ahead.
Nope. I'm going to kick it right back to you, Brian. Walk us through some of these details. Show us how Habakkuk artfully ties together the history of Israel. What do you see? And then I'll add a few points of my own as we come back to me.
Yeah. So one of the first things we see is how he starts the view of God, the theophany. And I've used the term twice now. A theophany is just an appearance of God, right, in the Old Testament. And they always come in very important inflection points in the story. And we start with God comes from Timon, the Holy One from Mount Paran. And this is the problem with the Old Testament sometimes, Tim, right? We're reading these passages and there's the people hear names and they're like, geography. Gosh, like, I don't even know where all the, you know, states are necessarily on a map. How am I supposed to know this ancient land? All right, let's break that down a little bit for us. So Timon is the principal city of the country of the people of Edom. Now, it is probably being used as a circumlocution or synecdoche to mean Edom. He comes from Edom. Obadiah chapter 9 does the exact same thing with a similar phrase. And then coupled with Paran, so Edom is usually to the south and east, right, of the promised land of the nation of Israel. And Mount Paran, especially Paran, is where the people of Israel had encamped when they sent the spies in. So pulling these two together, he is definitely pulling an exile Sinai, the promised land motif, right? He's trying to set us in, I say us, he's talking to his own people, right? He says, let's go back to the past. God comes to us at Sinai. He comes to us in the wilderness. He comes to us as we approach the promised land, right? See this vision of God. And right after that, you have a Selah. Pause. Let's focus on this. Let's think about it. His description then in the back half of verse 3 and verse 4 is what we see at Sinai, right? His splendor covers the heaven. The earth is full of his praise. You have light and rays flashing from his hand, right? It's this powerful view of this God arriving on the scene. Verse 5 then throws a curveball. And if we have any worship pastors listening to this, open challenge, write a worship song about Habakkuk 3:5, please. It's in the Bible, biblical descriptions. Let's go. I want to see it because I want to see what grandma does when she hears the worship song singing about God and his plague and his pestilence. Now, I mean, I'm only half joking. I would love to hear that. You'd probably get fired if you do this worship song, so maybe don't do it. But it's an odd verse, right? You're like, okay, wait, we just saw God arrive. We're in a Sinai mindset, maybe. What's this? Well, remember in the ancient world, a lot of these things are deities. There's a God of plague, a God of pestilence. And here's something that the Old Testament does because it fits its culture, but we don't think about a lot. The Bible likes to talk about, hey, you have these pantheons, other nations. If that being exists and it's a spiritual being, not a God, you realize that being marches to the orders of Yahweh. It's not independent. It's not a God in its own right. Job does this, right, with Behemoth and Leviathan. God says to Job, right, you thought I was these things, these terrifying monsters, these, right, creatures of chaos. I walk them around on leashes. They're my pets. They're nothing. Plague and pestilence are deified in most of the cultures of this time. Here, I take it, Tim, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I read this to kind of go, whatever God you think you have and is worshiping, they march in the army of Yahweh. This is trying to say, look, he's not just our God. He's not just big and powerful in our world. He is the supreme ruler. When he comes forth as a warrior, he can marshal anything and everything. There's nothing outside his control. Definitely a very different worldview, different mindset, but I think that's what's going on, especially in verse 5. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I think as we look to theophanies in the scriptures, there may be more than this. This isn't a great nomenclature, but there's at least two types. Sometimes God shows up and it's almost secretive and you're not really even sure, is this God? Is this someone else? I'm thinking of, okay, God comes and appears to Abraham in, you know, just before Sodom and Gomorrah, these kind of things. But the theophanies that are most memorable and those that are commemorated in song, in other songs, are those where God shows up in this incredible power. And just as you said, Brian, he puts all other earthly powers and heavenly powers in their place. It's God demonstrating his power. It's God demonstrating his control. And I think even of the Song of Deborah, right? In Judges chapter 5, where some similar imagery is used. You a lot of times have celestial imagery, stars falling. You have God's hand coming up. You have lightning coming from him. You've got chariots. You've got God dancing on the waters. But we see this. My basic point is we see this in moments of victory. Whenever God shows up, it is a demonstration of his total sovereignty and total control. In other words, game over, right? Job, I've seen you, you know, Isaiah, I've seen you and I'm a man of unclean lips. Like anytime we see theophany, it's a game over. Any other powers, heavenly or earthly, they are done. They are silent. And so in that sense, it's ironic, isn't it? That Habakkuk says, we're going to be silent before the presence of God. And then he writes a song, but it makes sense in that you have a song that declares God is one. The game is over and God is in control. So yeah, I like that. I never heard that interpretation, Brian, but I like that idea of God controlling all of the forces of chaos that seem to us to have held sway. I like that reading.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Open bounty. It remains out there, worship leaders. Let's get a worship song going. Anyway, we continue on in this powerful, God stands and shakes the earth. One of the common elements of theophanies is that the earth usually shakes when God arrives, right? You have flashes of lightning rumbling, the earth shakes, which is important and a tragic part of the Old Testament that we're not supposed to miss, that the dumb, inanimate earth recognizes its creator when its creator arrives, and yet humans often miss him when he arrives, right? There's a tragedy in that. Going down in verse 7, the tents of Cushan, the land of Midian, these are the lands Israel had to wander through and had to sometimes fight their way through in the wilderness on their way to the promised land that God had given to them. Verses 8 and 9 pick up, ask an interesting question, right? Are you angry at the rivers? Is your wrath against the rivers? And the answer is, of course, no. But multiple times in that exile Sinai promised land journey at the Red Sea, at the Jordan River, right? God parts the waters to let his people pass and then closes it up behind them, specifically in the Red Sea on the Egyptians as well, right? God has acted powerfully. And Tim, I think it's come up in maybe a couple episodes, but the exile is one of those kind of indelible parts of ancient Israelite thought. It is their prototype for God delivering them. And so I don't think it's out of character to see it here. In fact, I'd expect to see it here. This is what they go back to when they want to remind themselves of how God has saved them. It is through the exile. And it's just really powerful to me to see it here.
Can I just jump in on that, Brian? So we see, you know, we see in the Old Testament, we see recapitulation, we see echoes, we see God delivering his people from Egypt. And therefore, because we know God has delivered us from Egypt, we know that he's going to bring us back when he exiles us to other foreign lands. So it's a version of history repeats itself, but really it's the idea of God's faithfulness repeating itself. And that's important because for Habakkuk says, God, are you going to move? When are you going to move? How long are we going to wait? And basically God says, hey, rewind the tape so you can see what's going to happen. I'm not going to wait forever. I am going to move. So yes, doubling down on what you said, these motifs become so important in understanding what will happen in the future.
Yeah. In the last couple of verses, there's two other, at least explicit references that I could see or kind of pull out. Verse 11 talks about the sun and moon standing still, right? That's a very famous story from Joshua chapter 10 in the battle for the promised land. You have in verse 14, piercing his head with his own spears might be a reference to Numbers 21 with Shinon and Og and Israel fighting against them. But at the very end of verse 15, you tread on the sea with your horses and you stir up the vast waters. To you and me, that might seem like a dud of an ending talking about God as a warrior. And yet this is the peak in ancient thought. There is one source of chaos that can never be controlled. It is connected to death. It is connected to disaster. We're terrified of it. It's the deep. It's the ocean. It's the waters. No one can control it. Even with all of our modern technology, we brought this up before, right? If the ocean's going to flood, there's little we can do about it. God is the one who treads on the sea. Do you think it's an accident, by the way, listeners, that Jesus walks on the water? That's not just a, oh, cool, I can pull a neat trick. He's showing I do what Yahweh did. I can control the deep. I can control chaos itself, the source of all evil in your worldview. I have mastery over it. It is a strong and powerful conclusion to this view of God as warrior. And this whole poem, Tim, to kind of put a bow on it, is so wonderful because we're going to see next week, Habakkuk is terrified. He heard what God said about the Chaldeans, about the Babylonians, and he is not optimistic about his future. To help himself through it, his faith response is to recognize that no matter how terrifying the enemies look like, our God is all the more powerful. They might be, they being the Babylonians might be, you know, diminutive agents of chaos, but my God controls it. My God is above it. My God treads on it. And that's kind of a powerful capstone, right, to his point. The prophet is reminding himself because he's forgotten. God has acted in the past. We can trust that he will act in the future. We don't have to be so consumed with what's going on and what's going wrong in our life. We can remember that God has a track record. And that's part of why I love the Old Testament, is we get to see that track record of God remaining faithful generation to generation. And we can find strength and encouragement for the moment in that path. So I absolutely love this poem. It's one of my laments. It didn't make sense, but this poem wasn't really something I dealt with in my dissertation because my dissertation was focused more on chapter one and a little bit on what we'll cover next week. But I always, in reading through, I'm like, I always love this poem. I would have loved to do a whole lot more. But it's one of my favorite parts of this book, just all the rich, rich imagery here. But yeah, that's Habakkuk 3, 1 through 15. Tim, maybe bring us on home.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I so appreciate, first of all, your insights into this. And also, these to me, Brian, are the kinds of texts that a lot of times we as Christians living in 2024 don't know what to do with. There's all this imagery. It seems very foreign to us. But this is part of the expression. This is part of how study pays off. Because as we look at this, if we can see it as a poem that has a narrative arc, then all of a sudden it comes together and it makes sense. But if we just see it as a hodgepodge or a string of unrelated images, then we're going to misunderstand it. But I'll just end with this, Brian. You know, when we think about our culture, you mentioned synecdoche and circumlocution and all that. You know, these are fancy scholarly words that really are things that we use all the time and see all the time, but we just understand it. Let me just give two examples. It's almost the 4th of July, so I'll use some patriotic songs. You've probably heard the song, "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land," from California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. So think about that. Four different descriptions, California, New York Islands. Well, that's east and west and everything in between. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, again, east and west, north and south. In other words, it's giving us this idea of parts that represent the entirety or the whole. Or think of a narrative as well. Another patriotic song, the Star-Spangled Banner. The Star-Spangled Banner is a song that we learn, and it's a story. And when we sing it, we are singing a story of history that then leads us to think about the future. Oh, say, does that Star-Spangled Banner still wave, or the land of the free and the home of the brave? It takes us back in history in order to point us forward in history. So I just wanted to point that out, Brian. These are things that we still do, and we still do them with song. But the more we understand the imagery of Habakkuk 3, the more we're going to appreciate God is a warrior without equal. This will be my final thought, Brian. I think it's also important in Habakkuk's mind to extol the power of God, especially because the question is going to be in some people's mind, well, did the Babylonians, did the Chaldeans beat us because they were more powerful? Of course not. It's not that God was impotent, but that God gave us over to them. In other words, it's not as though God does not rule the cosmos, but in his sovereignty, he chose to let them punish us. Habakkuk reminds himself both to bolster his own courage, but as a reminder to everyone who reads this, it's not as though God has failed. It's not as though his promises have failed. God is still the warrior, but he is handing us over for punishment until the time comes for redemption. So Brian, so much. Thank you for your insights, and listeners, thank you for joining us. We're going to wrap up the book of Habakkuk next time, and then we'll have one final episode in this series, just orienting us and giving us some final thoughts. Thank you for joining us, and you know what to do. Until next time, stay cool and stay old.